I don't want a pickle. I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
NoComoto episode 33. We just enjoyed another of our 300 days of sunshine we get here in Northern Colorado. I'm your host, MotoGP, and with me is your other host, Swiggy.
Yep.
All right, let's talk bikes. And we've been on a roll of starting with best worst bike, and I say let's let the fun continue.
Let's do it.
Okay, so usual disclaimer, don't get your feelings hurt if you don't agree with our best or worst bikes in the world this week. It's just a fun way to look at a couple bikes a different way than you might normally do. And don't worry, there's going to be another best and worst bike next week. And also, as Liza once said, there's no crying in motorcycles. So, you know, just let it be. Okay, so having said that, we each choose a bike each week. We have no idea what the other has chosen. We alternate best and worst. Swiggy, you have best this week, correct?
Yep.
Okay. You ready to reveal it?
Let's go.
All right. And the worst bike in the world this week is?
Best.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. The best bike in the world this week is?
The 2001 Aprilia RST 1000 Futura.
Okay. So, what are we looking at here? This is pretty wild. The Futura name is definitely apt. This is 2001, and this definitely has a Tron look to it, but it doesn't piss me off.
So, this bike came out in 2001, and it is essentially the same motor that's shared between the Miele and the Cappenord.
Okay, I think I've zeroed in on exactly why you love this motorcycle. If I'm not mistaken, this is the exact same standard saddlebags that your Norge has.
I believe they're a little bit smaller, but it's the same design.
Okay.
Yeah. So this bike, I think it was something like 8,000. It was like maybe $8,500 to $9,000 at the time.
Okay.
It's...
Wait, how much again?
Like $8,500 to $9,000. Like pretty cheap.
In 2001?
Or sorry, no, that was in pounds. This bike was slightly more expensive than a 5th gen VFR 800.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, okay. It's Aprilia. It's an import. You're probably getting a little bit more power. It looks like a much larger bike, though. Like, a much larger bike than a VFR 800.
It's not that big. This bike is 460 pounds dry.
Ooh.
So just shy of 500 wet.
Okay.
With a 5.5 gallon tank.
Mm-hmm.
It's 113 horsepower and 71 foot-pounds of torque, which is a little bit more horsepower and 10 more foot-pounds of torque at the crank compared to a VFR 800.
Mm-hmm.
But that's coming down a little bit because you've got the shaft drive on it.
Yeah. But still good sport touring power.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, this is significantly cheaper and way more horsepower than the Norge has 6 years earlier, mm-hmm. 6 or 7 years earlier.
It's still red, Italian, and funky.
Yeah. And not only that, but it's absolutely bulletproof. It's a Rotax motor. It's a 1000cc, 60-degree V-twin, liquid-cooled. And not only that, but it's detuned down to 113 horsepower.
Yeah, because those Rotax V-twins, I mean, on the Buells, they pretty much maxed them out to get like 170-something horsepower out of them, 180 by the time they got to the, like the 1190RX. So, yeah, the numbers are making sense on this. And they were making more of these motors than they would have for, you know, Buell. The parts would be easier to get. You're going to have issues with getting Rotax parts, but probably one of the better scenarios for getting Rotax parts. I mean, outside of having a snowmobile, I guess.
Yeah. What I love about this bike is that if people really got their, really thought about what they wanted out of a sport tourer, This is the perfect sport tourer. And I say that because it's kind of sad, but this bike was actually a total failure. There's one on Craigslist in Brighton for $2,200 with like 20,000 miles on it.
What? Uh-oh. I smell something coming up.
Now, I think there's quite a few reasons why this failed, and it's really sad. And there is actually there is a UK website dedicated to this bike and how excellent it is, and going over the history of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a sad story, though. I mean, the bodywork and the styling were a little controversial at the time. There was a lot of mixed opinions. But I feel like
it's aged well.
It's aged very well. But you get this kind of, you've got this fully enclosed fairing, and it's very much in the vein of the VFR 800 in that, you know, in the spectrum of sport tourers, there's really two kind of categories. There's the bike that started as a sport bike and inched a little closer to the touring category.
Yeah.
And the bike that started as a tourer and inched a bit closer to the sport category.
Right. And those would be like your ST1300s, your FJRs, where I've definitely always been more of a fan of the sport bikes that just give you a couple more touring amenities. That's the way I like to go.
And that's exactly what this did. They, you know, it's still fairly light for a sport tourer. They dropped the horsepower down, so you only get 113 horsepower at the crank.
Oh, no.
You still got the 5.5-gallon fuel tank with the whole thing being under 500 pounds. And that includes a single-sided shaft drive.
So let's say, like, worst-case scenario, it's sapping, like, 30% of the horsepower. You're still getting high 80s, you know, right? You're still making, you're making at the rear wheel what the Norge is making at the crank.
Maybe not quite that much, but it's pretty close, yeah.
Yeah.
It's in the ballpark. On top of that, you've got these standard matching panniers, which they're not going to be as big as the Norge, but they're pretty damn... I think we've figured out that you can fit way more of the Norge than you could ever possibly need.
Oh, I know. Yeah, you had a lot of thoughts about putting a top box on or something, but the situation where you needed more storage just hasn't come up.
Right.
Even on 1,000-mile trips, so, yeah.
Now, I mean, it's got a few other things. So, this is something I don't really understand about the kind of people's opinions on sport tourers. When you have a sport tourer that's more towards the sporty side, then the bike gets absolutely pilloried for anything that is even remotely divergent from a full-on track-ready sport bike.
Yeah.
You can't have any extra weight. You can't have a bigger fuel tank. You can't have a longer wheelbase.
Mm-hmm.
You can't drop the horsepower to get more torque. It will just get nitpicked away until everyone just walks away bitter.
Yes.
But I feel like this is the perfect balance. And just in terms of power, the torque out of the V-twin, the fact that you've got a shaft-driven, liquid-cooled motor that's reliable.
A shaft-driven wheel.
It's just kind of perfect. And they're super cheap if you can find one.
Right.
Because they didn't make a lot and nobody knows what it is.
Yeah, it is odd. Like, you know, a lot of bikes in this category, besides the VFR, just never do well. I don't know why this segment of the market never really took off, because everyone tried it.
I don't think it's I don't think it's a question of how good the products are. I think it's a question of the people who would buy these bikes not really knowing what they want.
Right. And then they kind of all fell to the Harley mind frame, bigger is better. And then we end up with the new Concours and the ST1300. And they are mammoth bikes. Man, they're huge. You know, like I said, I always maintain that 500 pounds is a reasonable weight, you know, sort of across the board for motorcycles. I mean, you know, obviously if you're buying like a track bike, yeah, 500 pounds is more than you want. But sort of across the board for everyday use, 500 pounds is about right. But when you're talking about the ST1300 and all that stuff, you're going way north of that. And this is coming in below, and you've still got gobs and gobs of power that's going to make this great on the highway. And yeah, the wind protection looks awesome. And the design is great. It definitely has a sort of VFR-ish thing to it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but keep comparing it to the VFR 1200, which was a big flop. And maybe for the same reason, like it was sort of ahead of its time in the way it looked as well, like this thing. Though this is aged better than the VFR 1200. I love the VFR 1200. I think it's great. But I don't know. There's something about this. And I think it's the fact that although the VFR 1200 makes so much more power, it's still kind of a Honda, right? And unless it's a CBR, it's not going to elicit that sort of that passion within you. But this is Aprilia, right? And it's weird, yeah. And it's exotic, and it's Italian, and it's crazy.
Oh, you can't see it from here, but it's actually got a, instead of having to navigate an exhaust around the panniers or put it really low, this actually has, if you find another picture, this has an undertail exhaust.
Oh, yeah, it has to with those bags, that's right. Now, the only thing I could think, like the only two bikes that really ever did very well in this category are the Sprint and what was the Ducati one? The ST1, ST2, ST3, is that what they were called?
ST4.
Well, there was a 1 through 4 that kept making different. Yeah. But so the Ducati ST and the Triumph Sprint must have destroyed this. The Ducati must have come in at a competitive price to this, and people are like, well, Aprilia is cool, but I can get one that says Ducati, so...
There were quite a few... At the time, there were quite a few reviews done, and every time they did a group review, once journalists got their hands on this, they all loved it. There were tons of comparative analyses, you know, kind of like group rides where everyone was swapping between bikes, and they would get like an 1150 RS and a VFR 800 and a Sprint and an ST4, and it came out unanimously that the Futura was the best sport tourer.
I'll say one thing, I really love the handlebars on this because you're getting like sort of real sport, you know, handlebars. Because a lot of these bikes, they go for this like sport tour thing. But then when you actually come to grip the handlebars, they're just like regular street bike handlebars. They're not sport like this. And this is my favorite kind of handlebar, where they're clip-on style handlebars. But they come out and then they just rise up just 1 inch, but they attach in, you know, there's not the, what do you call it? The riser piece where an actual handlebar clamps in. It's two separate pieces that attach to either side of the steering head of the triple tree. I don't know. People know what I'm talking about. It doesn't have like, you know, 1970s handlebars on what's otherwise a really cool sport looking bike that always let down the Sprint and the Ducati ST for me. It's like, how are you going to take what I put my hands on and make that the least sporty thing on this entire machine?
Right.
You know, that's such a basic thing. You can still make them sort of come up to about the same height, but why are you giving me this bent tube thing rather than like, you know, the sort of riser clip-ons, like I like to call them.
Right.
Also, one little thing about this bike, I know it's 2001, but these are kind of piss poor 80s, 90s looking dials and gauges you're getting on this bike. They kind of dropped the ball there. But otherwise, the design of the whole bike is great.
That was very common. You wouldn't get anything much more advanced on a 2000 VFR 800.
Right. But this doesn't really... I don't know, the rest of the bike looks so ahead of its time. The rest of the bike looks like something that could pretty much come out today. And these gauges, I'm not talking about the fact that they're not like, you know, backlit in some impressive way, or they're not digital or anything like that. There's just a certain 80s-ness to them that's a little disappointing.
Yeah. There's also a few weird quirks with this bike. The weirdest one is if you look right next to the... to the clutch fluid,
mm-hmm.
there's a little keyhole.
Oh yeah,
that's the latch to lift the seat up.
That is weird. That's a convenient spot for it. I mean, that's cool. I bet you there's a lot of weird play in that key though. Like you have to lift up the seat while you're turning that. There's a lot. Yeah. That's a long linkage. That's not going to work perfectly. But I like where they're going there.
Right. So. Now, as to why this bike failed, again, a lot of, you know, the sport touring category wasn't that well developed at this time. There was like the ST1100 and some of the other kind of tours that became sportier, but the only bike that had pulled off the sport bike into sport tourer transition was the VFR.
Right.
And the VFR took quite a while to gain acceptance. And it was just really gaining in popularity, you know, a year after they released the fifth gen
model. Yeah, because the VFR was always sort of in and out of production. You know, and before it was really officially sort of a sport tourer, it was, you know, a V4 sport bike just called the Interceptor. And... It just sort of, I don't know, it never really caught on. It kept coming in, coming out, coming in, coming out. And then when it got to the 750, they finally locked on to what made it great and why people would love it. And then the 800, even better. You know, and you know, the 750 right. with the VTEC and all that sort of stuff. And then it really caught on. They actually made it less sporty. And that's when people started to love it. Because the way the V4 was at the time, it was just never going to compete with the 600s and the 1 liter inline fours. It just never was.
Right. So it had to really, it was really competing with the VFR that had finally nailed its persona and got the street cred that it needed to have to operate in this market. The Futura comes along, and nobody really knows what it is, and nobody really associates Aprilia with touring. Everyone's kind of doesn't really understand what's going on here.
Right.
On top of that, Aprilia had recently purchased Moto Guzzi. And they'd poured a ton of money into that. And while the Mille and the Cabanord were selling quite well, nobody really understood what the Futura was. And they didn't have a lot of money to dump into marketing for this bike.
Ah.
So, they didn't really want to take the risk and really start marketing it. On top of that, it was really competing with the VFR, which was a little bit better in 0 to 60 times. Mm-hmm. But when you really factor in kind of sport riding and touring, this was better. But you really couldn't prove it in a simple, you know, 5 to 10 mile test ride.
Gotcha.
So, yeah. Then what ended up happening is around 2005, right about when they stopped selling it, was right about the time that they got bought out by Piaggio. Because a few things happened. One, they got bought out by Piaggio, and Piaggio said, well, we'll let Moto Guzzi be the tourers, yeah. And the classics.
Yeah, let's revamp the California and, yeah, right.
And Aprilia will be the sport bike brand.
Which, I mean, if you're Piaggio, makes a lot of sense.
Right. But then you also have to consider that right around that time, it was right around the time that Long Way Round aired in 2005. And then a lot of the potential market for the sport tours all went off into adventure bike land.
You're right. You know, I never thought about that, but yeah, it wasn't until about 2001, 2002 that sport tours really started becoming good. And then Long Way Round came out and just stole the whole segment's thunder to go for straight up adventure bikes. Yeah. Yeah. And only the VFR is the one that we really still remember, even though there were loads of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, we remember, you know, the Sprint and all that, but the VFR is the one. And all these other ones have been forgotten. Yeah. Yeah, you and McGregor and Charlie Borman just fucking killed this bike and all the others. You're right. It never had a chance.
Right. So, it's sad, but if you can find one, it's an excellent bike. You can get them cheap as chips, but you gotta find one.
I don't know. Maybe they can, like, maybe the guys can make amends and they can do a special where they just do, like, I don't know, like, 400 miles on the Autobahn as fast as they can or something on sport tours. I don't know. There's got to be something they can do. I know we got Long Way Up coming, which I'm super excited about. Oh my gosh. I'm super excited.
This would be a great idea for like a spoof video with like Charlie Borman and Ewan McGregor just like in a courtroom, like Nuremberg trial style. Just like shown all the bikes that they've killed off.
You know, I wonder, I've had this thought because a lot of people have been thinking about what bikes they're going to ride for the new series. Because Charlie Borman's tied to Triumph now. And Hugh McGregor is a spokesman for...
First of all, McGregor.
What did I say?
McGregan.
Did I?
Yeah.
Oh, what? Ewan McGregor. I know. Yeah. Anyway.
Tied to Moto Guzzi.
That's right. So they could have, you know, bikes from those brands, which would make a lot of sense. But at this point, especially the way people trashed on them for the way that they got those GSs fixed on those other series, why wouldn't a whole bunch of different companies offer to give them new bikes, like, every 1,000 miles?
I don't know. It's a little tricky.
Why wouldn't they just ride a whole bunch of different things? And just for all the different crazy terrain, they can just sort of pick a weapon from all these different manufacturers.
It's so tricky, though, because, I mean, if you were a manufacturer, you know, you may have the best bike on the market, but shit happens. Do you want your bike to have that one shot on the show and then just fail catastrophically? And then now your brand is just tarnished forever.
I don't know. I think the show's going to be so popular. So many people are looking forward to it. When they did it the first time, KTM didn't want to give them bikes. They had no idea how popular it was going to be.
Right, but...
And this is only going to be that much more popular. People are thirsty for it now.
Yeah, I think KTM totally wussed out there.
And right, but this time around, but again, if they're not trying to do the whole thing on one bike and everyone's like, okay, we just need to supply a bike that's going to do 1,000 miles of this.
Right.
That's a pretty safe bet, and you can't say no to the exposure.
It's so it's so tricky if there's going to be lots of... I mean, if you're the only bike being used, then it's fine, because who knows? There's no comparison you can do. But if there's lots of different bikes and both of yours break down in that 1,000-mile stretch, that's going to be a gigantic hit to your reputation. And, you know, it's...
Well, it's they never even have to be on the same bikes at the same time, even within each segment.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They could just plan to do, you know, because they've got to go across, like, the Baja, right? So why wouldn't they get some, you know, CRF 450s for that part of it, right? And, you know, they're going to be riding through either through Colorado on the mountains or, you know, going up the highway of California doing the Pacific Coast. And why wouldn't you want why would you want anything but some bike like this, the Futura, right?
Yeah. This would be so much better than just an adventure bike if you're just going up the Pacific, the PCH.
I don't know. If I were those guys, I would do something crazy, and I'd be like, okay, people need to give us all the crazy bikes, or, you know, I will just threaten to get a $3,000 Futura for like huge segments of this trip. There's no obligation to use brand new bikes for the whole trip. If I were them, I'd be like, you know, there's all these bikes in the past. Anyway, we've gotten way off best bike in the world here. So yeah, in closing on this one, so like I said, we've got a bike that is now dirt cheap on the market. You can get with low miles. It's Italian. It's cool. It looks super sporty and aggressive. It's going to feel super sporty and aggressive. It's got plenty of power. You can get the parts for it. And it's just kind of a class leader as well to boot. So I don't know how you can say no on this one. All right, now we're going to do worst bike in the world this week. Strap yourselves in. And the worst bike in the world this week is the Kneeper.
What?
Okay. So this is less of a worst bike in the world and more of an essay, which I like to call the Kneeper, or Why Revzilla is Stealing Your Waking Dreams. Okay, so okay, so this is going to be the most controversial worst bike in the world we ever do. This motorcycle is surrounded by myth and cult, the cult of rivet counters, and the blurry fake past. There is a very small but very passionate group of people based around this bike. So it is the Kneeper, Kneper. I believe it's pronounced Kneeper. It is imperative, listener, that you stop right now and take a look at the picture that we're going to post for this thing, all right? I'll wait. Okay, so you've seen this bike before, all right? So this appears to be a vintage motorcycle with a sidecar. It looks very BMW. It looks very Ural. If a BMW R60 is the Ford Mustang of the Second World War, this is the Interceptor from Mad Max. I know that doesn't make sense, and it's not supposed to. Imagine any motorcycle you've seen from a World War II movie, and that's what we're talking about. And normally this is where I'd go into specs about the bike, but I can't actually go into it, into the specs. And I'll explain why shortly.
Is that a sprung pillion saddle seat?
Yeah, and that was kind of a standard World War II bike feature. I mean, I guess we can talk about a couple basic things here. I mean, but these are almost always sidecar rigs, though they weren't all sidecar rigs. You know, these have single leading drum brakes, you know, chunky tires, really tall fenders. Like I said, it's got a very BMW R60 kind of look to it, but it predates that in some ways. It's a lot of people thought these were Russian. They weren't. They were made in Kiev, actually. But they were made for the Russian military in World War II. And yeah, it's a World War II sort of hardtail sprung saddle thing with horizontally opposed flat twin. It is
It's got dual rear shocks with a sprung saddle for the driver and for the pillion.
Some are rigid, some have rear shock. Again, the specs I can't really go into again that much, and that'll become apparent why later on.
Okay.
So this is not really a motorcycle as much as it's a sort of organic manifestation of surrealism by the world itself.
Okay.
This was born of a failed and prepubescent ideology and exists only still mostly in the part of old men's minds reserved for thinking they can still be cool. Let me explain. So in England, near where I was born, there's a place, the Severn Valley. Emma will know it well. The Severn's a river. There's a valley which it goes through naturally. And there's a railway there. The Severn Valley Railway. It's a historic railway where they just do old steam trains. And it's mostly sort of operated by a special breed of cat that we call the rivet counter. The kind of guy who loves trains or any old machine, but is never really happy with any of it. Because the thing he loves so dearly is merely a fiction. There isn't really any historical train, right? Not really. The trains are sort of cobbled together from old yards of parts and, you know, a perfect original example will just never be unearthed, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Niebner is like this. So, like a dinosaur skeleton, even if it was complete, you know, the bones of the machine are partly or completely, you know, some sort of reproduction of the originals. And any rivet counter worth his salt, you know, which is, let me explain rivet counter. This is a person who just does nothing but complain about the authenticity and the teeny tiny details of trains, train models, and is just obsessed with originality, accuracy, and no one can ever know as much as they know, basically, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, they'll walk on a train, you know, and they'll say things like, "Oh, it's lovely, but you can tell the engine's a 43 because there's a 2 1/4 spacing on the bolts and there is a 2 foot spacing on the 39s, you know, much stronger, of course, but there was a shortage in 43, so they went to this and the cars are clearly 43. So, you know, you can't please them, right? And, you know, they'll be like, "Oh, you know, you can see there's the hook there where the Coleman could hang his cap on, and none of that happened until much later on." And it's just complete, just nitpicking tiny details. And this is the exact sort of crap that you read on the Niebner forums or Nieper forums, right? Because there's no such thing as a Nieper. Like there's no such thing as an old train. So this is the part where old guys listening to the podcast are just going to spit their decaf coffee all over their computer and just immediately start writing rabidly, you know, just terrible things to me about how I'm an idiot and I'm full of nonsense. And I may be, but hear me out. So like dinosaurs, we know some about Niebers, but the specifics of them get blurry really quick. So we know they're made in Kiev, not in Russia. And we know there's some sort of lineage from these to Urals and then to BMW motorcycles, but the specifics get confusing. And the Niebers were made probably, because I'm not totally certain about any of this, in several different factories in different areas, possibly in different countries, and with wildly varying parts, suppliers, and specifications.
Is this the AK-47 of the motorcycle market?
Kind of. So it's a rivet counter's wet dream, because so much can be debated on the true dates, the locations, and any other number of small details until the end of time about these things. What most people agree is that the scent trail of the production ends in 1991, or does it?
Okay.
There is a man in Ohio. He goes by the name Alex and other names. Are you starting to see a pattern? It is believed he purchased in the early 90s all the leftover, reject, and oddball parts for these motorcycles, and has since been selling, heavy air quotes, new Niebners to an unsuspecting public. He is the merchant of dreams, the Salvador Dali of motorcycles. He is a bridge between the dreams of old men and their real life wallets, and he is a wrecker of marriages.
So he's basically he's building these out kind of like
Well, he's building them, oddly enough, much in the style that they were originally made. And let me explain that. So when you want one of these, you go to Craigslist or eBay, and Alex, or whatever name he's going by, will happily take your order for one. When it arrives is a big question. Whether it will have a title is a big question. Whether it's the model you ordered is a big question. Whether that model ever even existed is a big question.
This is just making me think of the Johnny Cash song, One Piece at a Time.
It's sort of, yeah. So you'll order a specific imaginary model, and what shows up is a mystery shrouded in an enigma. The problems with it are you can't say that these had specific problems, although some people say the MT-10s or 11s or something were prone to snapping crankshafts. But beyond that, the thing is, if you get one now, because the build quality is so random, anything could be wrong with it. But what's pretty much guaranteed is that when you order one of these and it shows up, it won't run at all. And this is you buying a, quote, new bike. And I've read accounts of people buying new ones, waiting 6 months for it to show up, and then when it shows up, they have to do a complete frame-off restoration of their new bike.
Okay.
I think I heard, I can't remember if it was about Urals, but I think it was about these, maybe it was Johnny McElfresh from Cleveland Moto said something once like, the metal has been stepped on so badly that these are made out of that you can almost see the wood chips in it. And the first order of business is to remove the heads and wipe out all the metal shavings inside from these motors that have never run, right? So now when I say the Neepner isn't real, I mean it's surreal. Because, again, I don't believe there is existing or has ever existed in a meaningful way a Neeper. Because for me, for a motorcycle model to exist, there has to be a production run with some sort of standard to the specifications and equipment for it, right? And inconsistency is the most consistent thing about these bikes. Nobody, by any reliable account I can find, possesses a complete and to specification titled running example of one of these bikes. They all have something changed on them. They all have the wiring from 1 year and the suspension from another and the engine from another and the wheels from another. And they're all just sort of cobbled together randomly, right? And people will sort of announce theirs as a certain model because it kind of has like the most features from this specific model, but there really is no such thing as a model. So that's why I say it's not real, it's surreal. So, you know, the way they were made, I mean, every once in a while, people claim they have one that's like correct, you know, like they're standing up, like I have the real Shroud of Turin, but I'm not convinced. Right. So there was wild inconsistency, not just in the ones you get now, but when they were made originally as well. And that's because these were made like in World War II. And it's not so hard to believe that in, you know, some World War II Soviet space, there were motorcycles being built for the Russian army with wild inconsistency, right?
Well, yeah, anything built during wartime will have that where, you know, when you look at the beginning of any war, at the very beginning, all of the equipment is kind of, it's from the previous generation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all top notch because they got to have small factories produce it over a long time and build it to a really nice spec. But then as the war drags on, as things get more
desperate, tooling gets abused as fuck.
Well, that, and they also have to get a shit ton of unskilled workers who then need to pump out as much equipment as they possibly can. And all of a sudden, all this wonderful cast machinery turns into like a whole new design that's not as good, but they're using it because it's made out of stamped metal sheets that you can then just throw together insanely quickly.
Yeah, when I was imagining all the guys that were making these things, you know, in Armageddon, one of my favorite actors, Peter Stormare, plays the Russian cosmonaut that's been left alone in the space station for like 6 years on his own. Yeah. And he's gone a little crazy and he's just constantly drunk, right? I imagine just like a whole factory of Peter Stormare playing that character, just banging on tooling, being like, this is how we fix things in Mother Russia. Banging on crap, right? I just imagined like 50 guys of just him building these things. And yeah, so again, I want to talk about more about why I say this is a surrealist motorcycle. Surrealism is an art form meant to reflect a collision of the unconscious self with waking life, a sort of waking dream. So it's a mainly visual form where you're supposed to look deep into yourself and tap into what you can't quite put into words while you're conscious. It uses existing objects in photographic detail, combined and distorted into things you don't recognize. It's supposed to awaken the inner self, and the inner self of every old man is a boy who wants to be a badass on a motorcycle. So these people buy these things today, and this is where Zach Braff enters the narrative.
Okay.
So Zach Braff made a movie in 2004 called Garden State, which is essentially a loose remake of Reality Bites, which is essentially a loose remake of The Graduate. These movies were a sort of light surrealism because the characters are all just entering the real world after college. And most everyone around these characters speaks and looks normal, but they act and they have motivations that aren't consistent with how we, the audience, or the protagonist, sees the world as it is or how it should be. And this draws us in closer to their feeling of unease and closer to their inner child, you know, and who just wants things to be simple again and just to make sense. You know, if only we and the protagonist could totally escape into our dreams, right? And things could be great. What we hope could possibly, you know, be possible is. And faintly surreal scenes are shown to us in these movies, right? Dustin Hoffman in scuba gear at the bottom of a swimming pool. You know, he's drowning without drowning. Winona Ryder gets schooled in, you know, word definitions by a stoner. You know, she's an educated idiot.
Was that an Abyss reference?
No. No, that's Reality Bites.
Oh.
And then finally, in one of the most insane, surreal, impossible scenes in all of film history, is Zach Braff pulls a sheet of an out-of-registration neatener that by context of the film hasn't been started in years, immediately kicks it over and rides off. That is surrealism. Okay. That is the impossible happening before your eyes, something only capable in dreams, right? So when Garden State, or Reality Bites for Millennials, as I call it, came out, everybody wanted a Neeper because it was a big part of the film. It was a big thing, you know, and he and the girl, again, surreal, the girl who's into motorcycles, or riding around on this bike, and it's a very big hipster sort of statement and whatever. It was a big moment for motorcycles and films. This movie was everywhere. And no one knew what the bike was. They just wanted this bike from the movie. And that makes a lot of sense because these cheap Russian-ish bikes have been in tons of movies. These Neepers were used as the bikes in Indiana Jones. And like too many other movies to count. One of the reasons that the shot you see of people riding motorcycles in these like World War II movies and whatever, where the shot is just an upshot of the character from in front of the handlebars, but you don't see the front wheel, is because they got Neepers that looked the part that they could get for nothing, but they didn't run. So they just towed the bikes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why that's such a common shot on these bikes, right? Without knowing it, you've seen these bikes 100 times. you have in every movie. So it is part of your subconscious. It is part of your idea of motorcycles. And that's where this whole surrealist thing comes in, because you long for this thing. And so all of a sudden these people wake up one day and they're like, I need to live out this romantic dream, you know, and they're searching for this bike, but they don't know what it is. They don't know it's this thing. And then they finally come across it. But here's the problem. You know, some old guy decides he's going to do this. And that's not sexist or ageist. It's always an old guy that goes after one of these things, right? He decides he needs to live out this dream, this part of his inner self that's, you know, it's just been nagging at him, but he can't quite put it in. And then he finally stumbles across it, and it seems like it's going to be real. But as we've already discussed, the bike doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, the bikes are so bad that the dream of getting on one of these things and riding around, like, that's not real either, because you can't get parts for it. Because even if it is all original and perfect, they ran like shit. It's a common thing on the forums where people are like, oh, you can't actually use the original carburetors. They just didn't work. Right? And so on top of that, where are you going to ride it? Because this thing's making like 7 horsepower. I mean, it's a 650 or 750 or 500. Again, you can't really talk about the specs, but this thing won't really do 45 miles an hour even. Where are you going to ride it? And who are these people that are supposedly going to be impressed by it? The whole thing is a surrealist fantasy. And again, even when they did it a loose way, it may be, you know, they were rubbish anyway. These were just being cranked out, and, you know, and they're like, this, you know, this is like, you know, Russian military, like down to one bullet a day kind of stuff, right? How well do you think these things were really cranked out in the glory days? And so again, all these people like research and they go through all this stuff, and everyone has conflicting ideas, and no one, I mean, you can look up the Wikipedia and everything, and there are plenty of places where you can see something that looks like a convincing timeline for the production of these. But then you'll find a completely different account somewhere else. And then you'll find a know-it-all on a forum. And you ultimately realize that, like, all of this is just make-believe. Like, no one really knows.
And it's not that, maybe not that any one of those perspectives is actually wrong. But they're
but
all
none of it
parallel.
Can be proven, right? It's like an electron, like it exists, but we don't know where, right? It doesn't exist, right? And so it's enough to drive you mad thinking about it, because you're like, well, come on, these were existing factories. There are people that did this. You must be able to know. And like, the more you dig into it, you can't, and it drives you mad. But again, that's what rivet counters run on. Right? But us normal people can't deal with it. So in trying to put together specs from this thing and put together a logical timeline, I was nearly driven mad. Up at 3 a.m, just furiously trying to find out what's going on. And, you know, much like seeing the swans and the elephants in the Dali painting for the first time, I saw some things in this story. So I saw Peter Sarsgaard in his supporting role in Garden State. And then I saw Spurgeon from RevZilla that I'm really not comfortable with.
Okay.
And then I was nearly driven so mad I thought to myself, is the entire RevZilla business merely a vehicle for Peter Sarsgaard to play a bizarre spin-off role from Garden State? And is he assuming the role of Charles Spurgeon, famed 19th century English preacher from Severn Valley, leading us away from the all-too-liberal, read communist, ideas of the Niebuhr to the much more capitalist and orthodox virtues of the Ural, a bike in the style which does exist, which is reliable, although maybe not the greatest option? And, you know, and what comes along with that, the much more capitalistic and sensibilities of, you know, gear and modern technology, and then just throwing out that communist ideal of the youth and the dreams of old men. And then I saw this article from Spurgeon on Revzilla called Surviving L.A. to Barstow to Vegas on a Ural.
I think we may need to have a moratorium on conspiracy theories.
Hold on, hold on. So I saw this article and I nearly lost my shit. So Spurgeon literally taking the spiritual successor and direct DNA descendant of the Neatner through the desert or land of lost dreams, through Barstow, purgatory, to the Mecca of capitalism, like the preacher Charles Spurgeon, going to Las Vegas, and isn't that where we're going next month? It's madness, I tell you. This motorcycle, the Neeper, is a Dali painting in real life. It is motorcycle parts combined to look like something like a motorcycle, but isn't really, because it doesn't work and it never existed. And it's the myth of it. And it's the myth that connects with people's inner child and their memories from what they've seen inside of this, you know, in the movies. And then it's brought out to try to create some sort of vision of something they can do in the future that's impossible. And they're driven hopelessly to try to fill out this dream. And none of it can ever happen. And that's why this is the worst bike in the world. Not sure if it's better than a car. So there okay. You go.
Yeah, okay. I feel like this bike has affected you somehow.
It really did. This kept me up way late at night. I couldn't, I still don't know how I really feel about it. I mean, it's just, I don't know.
It's an interesting perspective that kind of, it's a bike whose whole concept is mythicized by Hollywood. In the same way that, you know, people think if you get shot by a big gun, you fly backwards.
Right.
Like, the same level of fantasy has been applied to the entire existence of this motorcycle.
Yeah. It's the stuff of dreams, and it just leads people down this path. That's why I said, you know, the Alex guy is a destroyer of marriages. Because, you know, these guys working on these bikes, I mean, you think about this, they end up just like having them in the garages, spending late nights, you know, and that thin line between, you know, the dream of ownership, you know, of this bike is a mirage in your mind, appearing in the thin space between happy marriage and living in your garage like Burt Monroe.
Okay.
I think that's a good final thought.
I think so.
Okay, so now we're going to do another update on the podcast bike, the Norge.
Yeah.
So I think we should start before you trash on the engineering of this bike a little bit. We should maintain that, you know, restate that we both still love riding this bike.
Yes.
It's the greatest, it's the greatest thing to ride. It's just wonderful that way. But it's very Italian in the maintenance schedule.
Yes. So I'm trying to get this bike ready and basically to go ride down to AIM.
Yeah.
And I kind of want everything to be just right. Because I do not want to break down in the middle of the desert in Nevada on an air-cooled Italian motorcycle.
This is why I got a liquid-cooled Honda, but yeah.
in fairness, I have really put off the oil change. And I don't think it had the right oil in it from the beginning.
Well, yeah, because it needed 1060, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you were running 1550 or 1050?
I suspect, and I'm going to get reamed for this, but I suspect the last time it was in the dealer, they filled it with 1040. And I've been topping it up with 2050.
Right.
Probably not the best idea, but...
But 1060 is a bitch to source.
It is. Well, I went and got a bunch of it from the local dealer because I didn't want to... When you factor in the shipping weight of it, it was about the same as getting it online. And it ended up costing like $140 for 8 liters, which is basically 2 fill-ups.
Right. But I did point out, isn't the oil change, like the recommended oil change interval, like 8,000 miles or something crazy?
It's not that high. It is that high for something like the Multistrada. It's not quite that high. This thing gets through a lot of oil. And it
but it's at least 6,000 miles on an oil change for that bike, right? I remember you saying it was pretty high.
I think it was like 5,000. It wasn't an insane amount. Okay. So you have to keep in mind, this is a 1,200cc air-cooled twin.
Right. I mean,
so it does, and even though it does have a 4-liter capacity, it chews through that oil pretty quickly.
That's true. But I mean, like on the Nighthawk, on the Superhawk, for example, I'm changing the oil every 3,000 miles, and that's cost me roughly $40. So, you know, I'm spending $80 over 6,000 miles, and you're spending $50 to $60 over 5,000 miles. You have to take a big kick in the nuts each time you purchase oil because you got to buy it in bulk. Mm-hmm. But over the long run, it's not a huge expense, but it's a pain in the ass to find that oil. You can't just get it when you want. You have to plan out the oil change like a week or two in advance.
Sort of, yeah. So I go to do the oil change. So I'm trying to just get the body work off to get to the sump. And very first bolt I try and take out to get the lower fairing off, it's rounded out.
Yeah.
And the bolt that's rounded out, so here's some weirdness around the bodywork on this bike. Even though the fairing connects at the bottom under the pan.
On the belly pan, yeah.
Yeah. It's the bodywork in the lower fairing is not all attached to the frame. Because there is no frame at that part of the bike. It's
right.
It's a stressed member. So on the lower fairing, you know, kind of starting at the top, it's connected to the frame. As you go down, there's like linkages between like the 9 pieces that are the frame.
Right.
But when you get near the bottom, there is a bolt that goes through the bodywork that connects it to the engine.
Yeah.
Right above the sump. And that bolt is a giant Allen key that's been rounded out.
Oh, man. So how'd you get it out?
Oh, I didn't.
Okay.
I said, fuck it. I disconnected it on the other side. And then there's like 3 bolts down the center where the 2 pieces of the lower frame are connected together. And I took that apart and had to like pry the grill out of all the tabs on the bottom side to get it off so that I had enough space to get the cover off.
I want to pause here for just a second. A lot of people laugh when, you know, you're working in the garage, you're working on a car or a motorcycle or whatever, and then someone shows up with a 6-pack of beer or a pot of coffee or a fresh pot of tea. And someone goes like, oh, shit, like you brought the most important thing. But you kind of have a laugh like, oh, yeah, he's brought the beer. Like, yeah, that's important. Well, this is why it's important. when you have that beer to go for, or that hot cup of tea, or the fresh coffee, it gives you that moment to step back from what you're doing, release a little bit of tension, and then you don't do things like strip out Allen head bolts. You know? Mm-hmm. Having the radio going, some music you're jamming, a buddy to talk to and bullshit, and a beer to have while you're working is a crucial thing to have. So you don't rush ahead and do stupid things like over torque and strip out really small things that end up being a giant pain in the ass for someone else, the next owner down the road. I mean, over torquing and stripping out is just the amateur way, right? You don't have to have the most crazy knowledge of engines and maintenance and everything. All you need is a phone, an internet connection for YouTube, an owner's manual,
basic tools. And a little bit of patience to not do $500 worth of damage in 10 seconds.
Right. And even if it takes you a little bit longer to do a basic job, when I'm working with someone on a bike or whatever, the way that they remove all these bolts and they keep them organized and all that stuff, that impresses me a lot more than them, you know, being able to go, oh, well, I know that the clearances for this are this number and whatever off the top of my head and what. You can look that up. That's fine. But there is a technique and a patience and a strategy to taking something apart carefully, which may be one of the most important skills you can have as a mechanic.
Right.
And so, yeah. So the next time someone shows up with beer and you laugh, like, you know, maybe just take a moment and like look at the person that doesn't get it and then be like, no, really, it's important. Anyway, I just wanted my two cents there. So, okay. So you're trying to get, at this point, you've got the belly pan off of the bike, right?
No, this is just the fairing.
Well, the belly pan's part of the fairing, but yeah.
So,
well, it's a split belly pan, which is weird, but yeah.
All right. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So I get it off on one side and the other side is just kind of hanging loose.
Right.
I also noticed that there's some like these little like metal spacers that are meant to go in between.
Right.
So one on the right side, the one on the left side is missing. And interestingly, I also found there is an Imperial Allen head bolt on the left side as well that was definitely not stock.
Okay.
So when I see lots of other Norges, I notice that most of them are kind of beat to shit and a lot of them have the lower fairing removed. I understand why now.
Okay.
Because, first of all, it's this colossal nightmare that makes no sense. It's not well designed. The way it bolts into the engine doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, the bike's already heavy enough. Why can't you just have a little bit of rigging or spacers that come down so you don't have to bolt it into the engine? You know, bolting into the engine for the fairing also is kind of a little drastic. But also, the way the fairing goes together, it looks very clean and symmetrical on the outside, but as you take it apart, there's a different number of fairing pieces on the left and right side. And even though they've put the fairing into all these different pieces, for some reason, you still have to take off one extra piece on the left side to gain access to where the oil goes in. That makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, it does make sense. And I've explained this to you like six times on the podcast already. The reason is because he's Italian.
Okay. I get enough body work off to be able to get the sump off. And as I go through it, there are 14 bolts around the outside of the sump. Which may seem like a little overkill, but whatever, you know, this thing has to be oil tight.
Yeah.
And it's 1060 oil, so okay, that makes a lot of sense. But the sump goes around the oil filter.
Mm-hmm.
which is out and exposed. So it's this giant square sump that goes on the underside. It's got 14 bolts on it, but then it's got an additional 4 Allen key bolts on the inside that circles around the oil filter.
Yeah.
I don't know how you're supposed to gracefully get this off and put it back on. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Because you're supposed to be a trained, certified Moto Guzzi mechanic in the shop who probably has a motorcycle lift with a hole cut out in the bottom of it.
Perhaps.
Again, easy Italian. They're like, well, he's buying a Moto Guzzi. It's a premium product. He's fancy. He's got an Italian motorcycle. He's going to take it to the dealer for every single bit of service.
Yeah, the market has decided otherwise. But
yeah, it's true. Yeah. Yeah. Sadly, I think this bike was made in an era where they thought that possibly Moto Guzzi was going to develop a following like, you know, the Ducatisti. There was going to be the Moto Guzzi T or whatever, the Guzzi T, the Guzzi Tizzas or whatever you want. And that never really panned out in the real world.
Yeah. So as I'm taking this pan off, or as I'm taking the sump off, I also notice that there's 4 Allen head bolts missing.
Yeah. So those were lost by the same asshat that stripped out the other shit and couldn't put things back together properly.
Right. So I finally get the whole thing off, and as I pull the sump off, the metal gasket that seals the whole thing up splits because it's part of it is still stuck to the top and part of it is stuck to the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah. That's.
So then I got put in this position where it's like, am I going to try and just line this up or tape this up and
no,
shove it
idea.
Back up no. and then pour 4 liters of oil that cost me $70 into it and find out if it's good? No. So,
well, this is great because this is you taking on the proper mind frame, which is, again, a patient one. You know, you're like, I could throw this back together. And, you know, there's maybe even like a 90% or 80% chance it'll work. But your mind frame is such that you're like, well, this is a cool bike. And you feel a responsibility to that bike. And it's some people say, you know, about classic cars, especially ones that they buy and they think they're going to sell and buy something else one day. You know, there's this saying that people have where they're like, I'm not really this car or this bike's owner. I'm its custodian for right now. Right. And, you know, this Norge by all accounts isn't really that special of a bike as far as bikes go. But it's always great, again, to have that mindset of, well, I'm just its custodian. And I need to do a good job of that. This isn't necessarily my thing to just fuck around with, even though it is. It's, you know, you're going to get more life out of your bike and you're going to have, honestly, a better time working on it if your mind frame is, I'm this machine's custodian.
Mm-hmm.
Approach it with the level of responsibility you would approach a job.
Right.
Yeah. So you're definitely doing the right thing. I mean, it sucks that you got to give up a week of riding while you're waiting on this gasket.
Unfortunately, it's rained a shit ton, so I would have been riding anyway.
Yeah. Although the W650 is pretty much back up and now, right?
Kind of.
Oh, maybe no. We'll have to get into that.
No, I just need to go spray some WD-40 on the spacers, on the swing arm, because they just bound up and I can't adjust the what are they called, the little bolts that back off to hold the rear wheel.
Oh yeah, the spindles.
Yeah, they just bound up and I just need to go out and put some WD-40 on them and to get them to back out correctly to adjust the chain properly.
Yeah, because that bike does need a few miles before you sell it.
Yeah.
Just sell it in all good conscience. You need just a couple test miles. You need to just work out anything that possibly, just to make sure it's all really, really perfect before you sell it on. Because you want to be that guy that sells it on just absolutely correct in every way.
Right.
Especially if you're looking to get money out of it to get a Futura. Anyway. So
I'd have to sell the Gucci for that. It's too much overlap.
That's true. Anyway, so at this point, you've got the sump off. You've got everything off. And all these parts are now just sitting here waiting on this gasket.
Yes.
And then it's going to be another huge pain in the ass to get it all put back together. Because this sump sits, what, 4.5 inches off the ground?
A little bit more. It's like 6 or 7 inches off the ground.
Oh, that high? Okay.
But you've also got to lay the gasket on it and line it up so that you can also get 18 bolts through the gasket. I think all I'm going to do is I'm going to take the...
Now, you might be able to get those bolts and everything from the dealer because that motor, I'm going to guess that sump is probably the same as it is on like the Stelvio and some other engines. You might look out there and get those replacements.
I've already found the right bolts and I just ordered them already.
Okay.
But I can put it back. I can confidently put it back together with 10 bolts and expect to hold oil and just space them out. And then when the bolts come, I can put them in because they'll arrive a little bit after the gasket. So I can confidently do that. So I'm okay with that. But
I don't know. If you're waiting like this long anyway, I mean, how much longer are the bolts going to take than the gasket?
Like a couple days.
I might just wait and put all the bolts in because then you can do the proper like star patterning across the whole thing and get the tension down correct amongst the whole. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons the gasket split to begin with anyway. Mm-hmm. You didn't have all the bolts in, so there wasn't even pressure around the whole sump as it was sat there.
I also think the guy who put it back together was kind of being a dick and specifically left all of the... He put all of the bolts around the sides and the front and left them all off the back.
What? Why would you do that?
If you wanted the bike to look good and in good condition to sell it.
Oh, because you can see that part a little bit more without the fairings. Yeah. The fairings cover the missing ones. Oh my gosh, what a dickhead. Ugh. It's disappointing. It's all right, the bike's in better hands now. I mean, geez, the bike still has so much life in it.
Oh, yeah. It just needs to be...
just looked after properly, that's it.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, the adventures continue with Italian bike ownership. Gosh. Can you imagine what's going to happen when one of us finally gets like a really tricked out Ducati and we have to go through even more crazy nightmares? All right. Okay. I think we should take a little stop here and then I think we've got another topic we can talk about after this. Okay, and we're back. And then, so I think the last thing we want to talk about today, I've been thinking about investment motorcycles. And if you want to go out and buy an RC213V special from Honda and drop, what are they, like $135 or something dumb?
$180,000.
There you go. You know, you can buy that and then just, you know, put it in, you know, a climate controlled garage thing and probably sell it for more money later on. I'm sure there's a way to unrestrict the engine and get the power out of it.
I mean, you can also just buy a boat and burn your money that way too.
Yeah. You know, and it's probably like, you know, Honda's sort of way to sell a car like Ford does with the Ford GTs. You know, they're like, oh, we're going to make 23 this year and people will.
We'll sell the bare minimum we need to homologate this for Le Mans.
Right. And then after that, you know, people will buy them for, you know, crazy amounts of money and they'll just become collector things and they're an investment and they'll within a year, they're worth twice of what the person bought them for. And that's just how that goes. But there's actually a lot of bikes that I think, because bikes work different, that you can get for $10,000 or less right now in basically concourse condition that I think will fetch 2, 3, 4, 5 times their value in the next 20 years, probably. Mm-hmm. So we've compiled kind of a list of our best picks for bikes that just as a regular, everyday, average Joe, you could pick something up right now, and 20 years from now, everyone will think you're the coolest fucking dude at every fucking show because you have one of these, and everyone's going to be like, oh my gosh, how did you have the foresight to get one of these, right? And some of them are easier to find than others, but if you have the money waiting and you can jump on it when one pops up, then, you know, you're going to be the king daddy. So the first one I want to talk about is probably the most attainable, the easiest to find of these, and probably the best bet. And that's the Ducati 999R. So this was the controversial successor to the Ducati 916. Most people hated the way it looked when it came out, but it's aged very well. And it's being recognized as a great performer. The bike won all sorts of championships, I think World Superbike Championships when it was put out. So it was a winner, it was a great bike, and the street version you could buy was really not very different from the one they were racing in World Superbike. And you can get a really low miles, perfect example for $10,000.
Well, you can get really good condition ones also around $6,000 to $7,000 as well. Right, it depends what you're going for.
If you're going for a classic, if you're going for something collectible, you should buy the best example you can. So you don't have to say like, oh, well, this part was repainted or this part was redone. Like, I know it's good. Mm-hmm. You want something perfect when you're going for this kind of thing. And about $10,000 gets you there with the 999.
Right.
And, you know, just on Cycle Trader, just, you know, immediately a whole bunch of them just pop up anywhere from like 4,000 to 7,000 miles at $10,000. Just, you know, absolutely perfect.
And it's also, you know, it's got the controversy behind it, when, you know, styling wise when it came out. But it's also just such a striking bike that has aged so well. It's the sort of thing that if you go to Coda and you're in the camping section, and everybody inevitably has their Friday and Saturday parades showing off their bikes, just riding around the campsite. This is the sort of bike that's going to show up 10 years from now as just that shining, like, period perfect, cool bike.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, you can still probably put, you know, a few hundred miles a year on it. It's not going to hurt the value too much. But if you bought one of these for 10 grand right now and just sat on it, you're going to sell it for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 before you know it. So that's a great buy right there. And now I want to move into something a little bit more unexpected that you might not think about. I want to talk about the Buell RR1000. So the Buell RR1000 is the first Buell. And there are not very many of these at all. This was just a race only bike. I don't even think it's street legal. But it might be. But it's kind of like almost impossible to find one for sale. But if you can, Hagerty, which is, you know, the blue book of auction things, list these is worth about $9,000 for a perfect one. No one gives a shit about this bike right now. I mean, I'm going to guess there's probably like 30 or 40 of them that exist. And, you know, probably 35 of them exist in the hands of collectors or whatever. But there's got to be like some weird Harley dealer somewhere that just has one on display. And you might be able to wrestle it away from them or something. But if this was, if this is on your radar, and it's on nobody's radar, right? It's 77 horsepower. I mean, it's not that fast or whatever, but what it is weird and kooky and strange. And one of the things that makes things jump crazy in value is a history and a story.
Right. Especially now that, you know, if you browsed around and you asked a lot of people about Harley getting into kind of more of the sport bike in the younger market, with the Street Fighter and potentially having some fully fared or partially fared models of these bikes, there was instantly a backlash to that because of the way that Harley treated Eric Buell and all of the Buell bikes. So now, you know that as soon as the Street Fighter comes out and people start buying them and riding them around, all of the Buell owners will have this little piece of history to shove in those riders' faces.
Exactly.
And now you can go like to the top of the mountain and get the RR1000 now.
Mm-hmm. It'll be tricky. You're going to have to make phone calls. You're going to have it in cash, or you might have to pay more than $9,000 because someone thinks it's worth that. But this is going to be a $200,000 motorcycle one day. Just because the attachment to Harley, the crazy history of Buell, Harley returning to more sport-oriented bikes. You know, at some point, Harley's going to have a racing program again, and this is going to be that diamond in the rough weirdo thing. And the bike is so unusual. It's Buell weird. And this is 1987.
So we're into six figures now. So I'm just going to say we are by no means experts. And if you go just on our word, you're an idiot.
That's true. But I mean,
this
is the perfect storm, though, of like, you know, these things exist. They're super rare. No one cares about them, but they have a low value. But all the pieces of what makes something collectible are there. And I think if we check out this, you know, this Hagerty listing on the value of one of these 2 years from now, it's going to be $20,000. It's going to be $30,000. It's going to just keep going up and up and up and up. So there you go. There are some other very similar Buells. There's like sort of an XB version of this, and there's a tube frame Buell race only version of this as well. And those are going to be worth some money too. But the original one with Hagerty saying it's only worth $9,000, like, come on. If you come across one of these, you're an idiot for not buying it. It's as they say about some of these collectible vehicles, it's better than the stock market. So do yourself a favor. Okay, now let's move on to one that's probably going to have some of the least return, but I think a pretty safe bet. And this is the one that you can buy and collect and ride as well, and it's still going to increase in value a little bit for you. A first generation VMAX with the V-Boost system, right? Because the VMAX now doesn't have the V-Boost system. It's got a different way that it boosts the power. And
well, it doesn't make any sense without fuel injection.
Right, yeah. The original Gen 1 carbureted VMAX. So you can get these anywhere from like $3,500 to like $8,000 for a really, really good one, right? And that's crazy because this is a bike from the 80s, right? What other bike from the 80s still demands that money? Very few. But again, VMAX isn't on anyone's radar as a collector's thing. But this is like the Chevy Impala of 80s motorcycles. This is the what's the crazy muscle car that everyone's always nuts about? The not the Charger, not the, oh my gosh, there's a G in the name. people are just screaming at their phones right now telling me what this freaking car is. But anyway, this is like, you know, the 60s muscle car. This is the VMAX, right? This was the badass thing back in the day. Big displacement, awful emissions, cool technology, outrageous styling, right? This is, you know, the baddest thing. And what's most important about this is a motorcycle that could never exist again the way that it exists, you know?
It's crazy to think this existed at the same time as the Magna.
Right. This is a nuts bike. And it's just a fun bike to ride as well. And this won't be so, because they made quite a few of these, this won't be so collectible that you can't ride it. You should just put it away and then not ride it. You can ride this thing and you'll always be able to sell it for what you bought it for.
Right.
Because they kind of went through a really uncool era. There's a time when it wasn't cool to have a VMAX, and a lot of them were abused and people thrashing through the gears, not using their clutch correctly. Like, second gear is blown on a lot of these things, right? So if you get a good one and hold on to it, put a few thousand miles on a year on it, like forever, and then sell it and buy two of your kids like their first cars, you know, when they go to college or whatever. Like, that's sort of the investment level on this one. Whatever you buy it for now, it will equal two sort of okay budget cars in the future whenever you want to unload it. Because it's never going to be worth less than what you pay for it as long as you don't crash it. That's what this bike is. So this is a much lower investment, but I think a smarter one.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's low risk. Okay, so let's go to... Oh, my favorite. How could we forget? Another one of our best bikes in the world. If you haven't noticed a running theme here. The 1984 Kawasaki GPZ900.
Now, don't we have a Top Gun drop for this bike?
I know, we really should. Every time we bring it up. So I started telling people about 4 years ago that they should buy these things up. And 4 years ago, you couldn't give these away. You couldn't even give them away. And now they're all getting bought up. They're all getting found in people's garages. And people are restoring them. And they're starting to fetch money. And one of the telling things that if you look this up on Cycle Trader, you can't even find any right now. These things used to be all over Craigslist, all over the place. No one gave a shit. They're like, oh, some like super old ninja. Why do I care? You know, but now everyone's realizing the historical importance of the motorcycle, and everyone that has one is holding on to it. So if you can find one that someone's willing to part with, I think this is like the Ducati 999. If you can get a really good one, I think $10,000 would be maybe a bit high at this point. But you know, $6,000-$8,000
for like $6,000.
Yeah,
like
$6,000 to $8,000. In
like hermetically sealed from factory new for like $6,000.
Right. And this one's going to be sort of like the Camaro, where they made a shit ton of them. But the old ones, the original, it's still worth a shit ton of money anyway, because they're just that fucking cool. That's the space that this one occupies, I think. This is like having, you know, a 60s Camaro in terms of motorcycles. It doesn't matter they were all over the place. It's still fucking cool, and every dude still is going to want one, right? All right, and then did we have one more? Oh, yes. In the line of sport bikes again, the 1985 Suzuki GSXR 750. So this is the original, like, we're taking the production race bike and just selling it to you, basically. I mean, not exactly, but close enough. Standard, complete full fairing. The GPZ 900, yeah, was a full fared bike, but not full race fairing like this was. This is nasty power, This was track level everything, right? You know, the earliest example, and really, you know, as much as the GPZ 900 set the standard for sport styling and where it was going to go.
And even like, I would say even 5-6 years ago, people thought this bike looked stupid.
Oh yeah.
And it, you know, it is a little bit goofy, but even in the last few years, people have really come around to really appreciate the hodgepodge prototype-esque primordial design of the fairing.
Yeah,
and
that
the headlights.
That super thin but still almost modern looking twin spar frame.
Yeah.
Like nothing had a twin spar frame before this. Nothing. Yeah, and the brakes way ahead of their time, the exhaust way ahead of its time.
Like the horrible aerodynamic where you've got all this swooping bodywork and then you've just got these flat headlights at the front.
Yeah.
But it's very, I'm going to say primordial.
Like there's something, yeah. It's, I don't know. I the more I look at it, the more it starts to look like a classic, like Isle of Man TT bike.
Right.
And I realize, oh, it's the 1980s version of that. And at some point, if you're my age, you're like, well, the 80s doesn't seem that long ago. But, I mean, it's fast approaching being that long ago, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I guess, you know, just because of my age, the 80s has never seemed that special of a time.
Well, everyone kind of thinks that time freezes after they hit the age of 13.
Right.
And then they realize that, oh, I'm hiring people that were born after The Matrix was released.
Exactly. Right. So, you know, it just takes a little bit of time. But jump on the bandwagon and start buying up this, like, especially cool stuff from the 80s. There's not as much cool stuff from the 80s as other decades, but we've given you three amazing examples right here in the VMAX, the GPZ 900, this, oh no, four, and the RR 1000 Buell. This is the time to invest in something 80s and motorcycle. And if you want to go really, really safe at that medium sort of level, the Ducati 999R. And that's post millennium. So yeah, I don't know. If you have a suggestion for something that we missed, something that's like totally off the wall, like, oh my gosh, how could you not talk about buying this as an investment? Like, send it to me, because I've always got like these bikes in my mind. And, you know, when I say them to people, they think I'm crazy. And then a few years later, they're like, oh my gosh, I totally should have bought one of those. It happens all the time. I don't know. If you have another suggestion that'll blow my mind, I really want to hear it. Yeah. Anything else you got to add on this one, Swiggy?
I think we're good.
I think we're good too. All right, so I'm going to remind everyone that they can send us an email at nokomotopodcast@gmail.com. Leave us reviews on iTunes. Let us know if you want to potentially call in and do best worst bike in the world with us. And with that, I'm going to remind you to stay safe and stay tuned.
And I don't want to die. Just want to ride on my motorcycle. Cold.